Hi, I am Mordechai Becher.
And I am Yehoshua Karsh.
And welcome to our blog, Two Rabbis and a... Sorry, not a blog, a podcast. Two Rabbis and a Podcast. And
it has podcast in the title of it.
Yes, yeah, so the Two Rabbis and a Podcast podcast.
That's it. Here you go.
Yeah, okay. We have to think about that. Maybe that's why we have so few viewers. I don't know, but if anyone
where do you get that? Don't listen to him.
Subscribe.
Every one of you matters.
Your friends, of course.
We have hundreds of viewers. You just because you're used to tens of thousands of viewers on everything that you do.
No, just
hundreds is a very respectable number.
Because I see,
and every person matters.
I see things on YouTube which are complete inane, ridiculous, insanely. Like just non-factual lies, classes which are just ridiculous and stupid, and they have hundreds of thousands, millions of hits. It's annoying. It's annoying.
I just want to say they are separating out the people who would not appreciate what it is that you have to offer.
We're the
Thank
elite.
God those people are being distracted.
Okay, we get the elite. Okay,
that's it.
All right. So today's topic is what is not.
That is correct.
Why don't you introduce it?
Right? I'm going to introduce it. This is a project very dear to my heart. Mordechai and I have had a opportunity to have many, many fruitful conversations about this project.
What he means is vehement arguments, but okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So, it is a museum that for several years has continued to exist only in my mind. I am the curator of said museum. I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of every aspect of it. It is called the Museum of Things You Would Expect to Find in the Torah, but Do Not. So the notion is best summed up in a couple lines from the Sherlock Holmes story, Silver Blaze. There is a detective standing next to a police detective standing next to Sherlock Holmes. Silver Blaze, a racehorse, is missing. And the detective says, he asked Sherlock Holmes, is there anything else you want to draw my attention to? And Sherlock Holmes says, yes. The curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. Gregory says to him, the dog did nothing in the nighttime. And Sherlock Holmes says, that is the curious incident of which I speak. So sometimes it's not what is there that begs questions, but what is not. You expect something. You expect something. In this case, he expected the dog to be barking. A dog should have barked. Why didn't the dog bark? So he is puzzled by, he is drawn to the question of something that should have been there but isn't there. And that's the notion, that's the basis of this museum. This museum focuses on things that you would expect to find in the Torah but do not.
That's a key term, expect. And
in
other words, that's not so clear cut, right?
Yeah.
One has to, you'd have to have a good reason that something should be there. You'd have to say, this should be. Now, why should something be there? You're right. Dogs should be barking at night. They tend to be.
Right. And especially if a stranger is walking in.
Exactly.
To this place, the dog should have barked. Right. So I'm going to now list several topics that are dealt with in the museum. Now, again, some of Mordechai and my discussions about this, which he's characterizing as heated, some of our discussions about this have been about whether this really is missing. In other words, what Mordechai is saying, that you, why did you expect it to be there? You shouldn't have ever expected it to be there, something like that. Or
two things that we argue. Number one is, why would you expect it to be there?
Right.
Torah is not Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right.
Right. And secondly, some things which I think actually are there.
Right. Yeah. And that would be, again, those are different ways to approach it.
Right.
And again, some of these are, many of these, the big ones are all discussed by, you know, people over the ages. And some of the ones that annoy Mordechai more are not, but they're the smaller ones typically. The bigger ones tend to get a lot of discussion. And so amongst the big ones are Olam Haba. Why is it that we don't find a discussion of Olam Haba in the Torah? Certainly the Gemara, the Mishnah points out.
You mean the world to come, the afterlife.
Right. What happens after you die? Not simply the specific notion of Olam Haba, but just what happens after you die. Certainly there are references to the fact that something happens after you die here and there, but there's not a discussion of it. And that's one of the things that many wonder about. Why isn't it there? Even in Ramos Shapiro, once said to us that he thinks it's one of the best questions about the Torah. He really liked the question, which is I think he characterized it as, where is Olam Haba in the Torah? But as you're saying, what happens after we die?
Actually a question that is addressed by at least 9 of the great commentaries.
And we're going to get to that. We're going to get to the discussion.
It bothered them.
Right. And this is a thing, again, that you don't need to have the answer. And we know that about questions in general. We should not be afraid of questions. We, as a culture, embrace questions. We love questions. That's how you get from one place to another. It's the Yiddish great quest.
Phrase, the Yiddish phrase, starb nicht from a kasha.
Yes.
Must not die from a question.
No. And certainly, as Reb David Cohen once pointed out, when he was they were talking about the age of the universe and contraindications about, you know, how old the universe is, etc. And he said, there's nothing wrong with saying it's a good question. Rabbi Akiva Eiger asked hundreds and hundreds of questions, which we celebrate. He's asking him on the Gemara. He's asking questions on the Gemara. And he leaves it as a kasha.
Many of them don't have good answers. I mean,
it's exciting. It's exciting when you have a good question. That's how it should always be. And so this is, you know, in that spirit, these are in that kind of spirit. These are because they really are pathways to a deeper understanding of Torah when you find them. So there's that question. I also believe that I would expect there to be discussion about the nature of Hashem, in the Torah. Now, again, there are people who respond to it. There are answers to this question about why it might not be there. And somebody might even say there's a lot there that is being shown to you. It doesn't always have to be described to you, etc. But I think a lot of people would assume that there'd be a discussion of the nature of Hashem, the nature of the human soul. What is the human soul? The nature of the human soul. Dinosaurs. This is a favorite for kids when they visit the museum. The kids like the dinosaur section. Where are the dinosaurs? That's one of those questions that gets asked a lot.
Did a zoo tour, a Torah tour of Kansas City Zoo on Sunday, and they have dinosaur effigies all over the zoo, which kids mark off on their on the sheet of a type of like a scavenger hunt to find all the different dinosaurs. So
somehow that's more interesting than the actual animals at the zoo.
I was upset. I'm not against dinosaurs, but I mean, you're at the zoo to see living animals. That's why.
Hey, look over here.
Exactly.
Look away from the giraffe.
It's really annoying. Okay, yes. Okay.
Okay, so another one. This is one that bothers me, that doesn't necessarily bother everybody else, but it bothers me, which is the Jewish people entering the land of Israel. I would expect the Torah to include the Jewish people entering the land of Israel. This is based on a notion that if you're moving in that direction, and really from the time we meet Avraham,
okay,
where he is being moved in this direction, that eventually his children are going to inherit this land. The children are going to inherit this land. And then it moves forward with the Avos. And then when we leave Mitzrayim, this is the direction that we're going in. And it seems to be moving in that direction. There is the playwright Chekhov. I am not talking about the navigator on the USS Enterprise. I'm talking about Anton Chekhov, the playwright, who said, if you have a gun hanging on a wall in the first scene, it better go off in the second or third scene. Now, is it what?
When you say missing in the Torah,
I mean the five books. I'm talking about the five books. No, I'm talking about the five books.
Because we have the entire book of Joshua.
I know, of course. That. Yeah. Now I'm sticking.
And this, by the way, it's interesting. The Talmud actually says, had the Jews never sinned, we would have only received the five books of Moses and the book of Joshua,
which most likely is Moses,
because of the commandments, and the book of Joshua.
See, already we got that. Israel, already we
the
went
borders,
there. You gotta love that.
The settlement, the conquest, etc. But isn't the issue chronological there? I mean, the Torah ends with the death of Moses.
I know, so you could say it's text. But I'm saying when a book, you could give a technical answer to why this didn't happen, but then it underlines the impact of that event of Moshe's dying, that somehow Moshe's dying early is not only an issue for Moshe's personal life, but it dramatically,
it doesn't mention
it like chops out a section of a section that should be in the Torah, an entire gaping hole at the end of the Torah is created because, according to you, that was the explanation. Okay, anyways.
All right.
So that's another, I'm going to put that in the big question section. And then there's a smaller section.
Can I add one more to that?
Yeah. Section? Oh, please do. Yeah.
Along the lines.
Yeah.
The city of Jerusalem is never mentioned.
Yes. There you go.
It's always referred to
that place, which I will choose.
The Lord your God will choose.
Right.
That's actually addressed by the Rambam.
Yes.
Addresses that.
Yes, but I like that. Thank you for including that there. Okay. Here are some of the smaller ones.
And watchers, that Jerusalem is mentioned about 700 times in the Tanakh.
Right, but we're talking the five books. Okay, so now in the smaller questions section, one sort of like that, which is that Rosh Hashanah is never identified as the beginning of a year. The holiday of Rosh Hashanah is not identified as the beginning of the year, which again, this is, it's not in the, it's one of those little ones that sort of tickles you a little bit. And I know as a teacher, when you're teaching people who've don't have a lot of experience with Torah, this is always surprising to them. Also, the connection between Shavuos and Matan Torah is not directly dealt with in the Torah. You could indirectly get to it, but it's not directly dealt with in the Torah. Then there's
Also bothered by the name Shavuot?
Yeah. Now it does
it really means
have
week.
It. I know. Yes. I know. Weeks. Weeks.
Wait, why is that even significant?
Right. Right.
Strange. Right.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
Used to talk about that, actually. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, and here's the even smaller ones that are I would call them more like tickles. There are no deaf characters, no deaf protagonists in the Torah.
Although
they're blind.
Deafness is mentioned.
it's mentioned.
They're not
but,
cursed
but,
to death.
Right, but you don't death. Have you have you have blind you have two blind moments. Again, this is blindness, age-related blindness,
Yitzhak.
But
yeah.
which is Yitzhak, and then Yaakov, it seems like, at the end when he gives you also, if we were going for Tanakh, you have Elisha at one point who is blind. But but you don't have an age-related deafness would have existed. I have some doctors in my Daf Yomi class, and I once brought this up with them, and one of them did research on it. And it seems like there were people who were speculating maybe nowadays, because there's so much noise pollution, that there's more age-related deafness. But it's referred to from ancient times, age-related deafness. And so there's no deaf people. There are no martyrs. There's nobody who dies. Again, we're talking about the text, not Medrash. In the text, there's nobody who dies because of their faith in God or their allegiance to God in the five books.
The text, right?
Right. There's no cats.
That, by the way, just apropos of that first point you just made, that's a question the Maharal points out something fascinating. He says, you know, all the stories about Avraham, with the furnace and his martyrdom, the fact that he was prepared to be a martyr, none of that gets mentioned in the Chumash. And the Chumash, the Torah begins out of the blue with Avraham. Like, if you contrast it with Noach already in the previous, like, his parents call him Noach because it means he will give us comfort. And it says previously that he found favor in the eyes of God. And we are told that he was righteous. And then God speaks to him. So we understand. Abraham, we know, other than very little genealogy.
Cryptic. Very cryptic last few verses.
Nothing about him. Nothing exceptional. Yeah. And the Torah goes, boom, out of the blue.
Yeah.
God says to Avraham, go to Israel.
Right.
And the Ramban both discussed that.
Nice.
Maybe we'll get a chance to discuss that.
There are no cats. There are dogs, but there are no cats. Now, the reason it struck me is also because Egypt, you have the Sphinx, you have Egypt, you have them sort of associated with cats. Like, if somebody was doing a movie, I bet you in the Ten Commandments, there were some cats walking around. They had cats, but you never see anything about cats. Now, you know, at a museum, the docent, when he's taking you around, they usually have corny jokes. So the docent at our museum, when he takes people around to the cats exhibit, he says there are no cats. He points that out, except there are Kohanim.
There are?
Kohanim.
Kohanim?
Yeah, cats. Got it? Cats. There's no cats. Cats!
Oh.
It's a docent. It's his idea of a corny joke. They don't have to be approved by everybody. The board doesn't have to approve the jokes. It's just what they say.
That will go in the collection of dad jokes known as the database.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Well done. Okay, this is the one, believe it or not, this is the question that got me really going in the direction of this museum in the first place. Infant, what we'll call natural infant mortality. It's not natural for an infant to die, but the idea that an infant would die not because of war or because of anti-Semitic programs of the Egyptian pharaoh, but just that if you're recording a family's genealogy, I mean, I used to do research on my own family's genealogy, and there's hardly a family that you won't hear lost somebody in this in the influenza epidemic or this or that. And infant mortality, they have records of infant mortality that go back to Roman times. Mm-hmm. It was obviously it would be such an important factor, and the Torah emphasizes having children right from the get-go, and certainly with Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, it was a featured issue about Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel. You know, having children is so important, and the genealogies of these families coming out, and yet there's no discussion of infant mortality being a part of it. Well, is it because they didn't die? Is it because for some reason they decided not to mention them. Every once in a while, it'll mention like it'll mention Aaron, and it'll mention that Nadav and Avihu died or something at a previous event. So you'll have something like that, but this isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, just in right. the normal course of having families, you would expect that this was an issue that people dealt with, and it would have been for a culture that's keeping such records of what's going on with childbirth. It was just interesting to me that it wasn't there. Then did I have a few more, but I just wrote a few down. All right. So those are, oh yeah. The other one is, the way I'm going to say it now is, there are no fish korbanos. There are no fish korbanos. There's actually a medrash that asks this question. Why aren't there a medrash Tanhuma that asks about it? But the reason, this is the way to bring fish up, because I've been
on the altar, a gefilte fish offering.
You know, there's not a kiddush worth its weight in anything if it doesn't have herring in it. So the reason I brought it up, this, I just want to bring up the fish thing, because there's several places where you expect fish to show up and they don't show up. Parshas Noach, there's no treatment of what happened to the fish over there in Parshas Noach. And I even one time tracked all the elements from the bracha that's given to Adam HaRishon. Pruer vu amilas aretz v'kiv shuha uredu b'tgas hayam ofa shamayim and behemos, whatever, that are apnei chayisos, apnei whatever, asada. And so each one of these elements, if you look in Parshas Noach, you could see some kind of reference to each one. You have Puravu, you have the discussion of his children, you know, having children, etc. And it's a matter that comes up with the whole Chum thing. And then you have Milos Aretz.
Fish are mentioned.
Right. No, I'm saying,
we ate fish in Egypt.
No, and I'm saying in the Noach thing. In Parshas Noach, it's something that bothers people. You know, it comes up. People ask, like, what happened to the
definitely
fish?
Definitely get a mention in the laws of kashrut.
No, fish are mentioned. But there's some places where
Moses
expect fish to be.
Moses saying, collect all the fish in the sea would not be enough. And
right, so, he says that about when they ask for meat.
They ask for meat.
Right, he says that. I'm not saying that fish are not mentioned at all, like cats. Cats are not mentioned. But fish are mentioned, but there are several times where you expect them to be, and then they aren't. One of them, a lot of people have about Parshas Noach. Where are they? And then I'm adding the why isn't there a fish korban? And you
I did hear an interesting, just apropos of that.
Yeah.
Again, we're not answering all of these.
Right.
Are we planning on doing that?
No.
Okay. But I'm saying apropos of fish, there's an idea. There are some authorities that maintain that the prohibition against causing pain to animals is primarily applied to the land animals, and some say because of their similarity to us. So it's easily transferable, the causing pain to them, to a human being.
Which is what the Medrash Tanhuma says. But the Medrash Tanhuma says specifically that it's one of those midrashim that's almost like a medrash pliya, because it says things and then you immediately wonder about what it's saying. But it says that land animals, the animals that are available for korbanos, which are animals and birds, it says they are born directly, like from their mothers. They are not, whereas fish are from eggs. Mm-hmm. And what was the other thing? There was two things about it. Each one. So
what I was saying, but this is based on the Ramban.
Right.
One of the ideas behind the sacrifices, and the Rav Hirsch says this, is I'm giving myself.
Yes.
I'm giving my flesh and blood.
Yes.
I am saying I am prepared. This is me. So it's very, so fish are so different.
Yeah.
So radically different. Different environment.
Yeah.
Different system. Breathing differently. Yeah. That that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make that type of dramatic comparison.
It seems like some people want to understand that medrash in that way too, that they're like, for instance, their parents care for them after they're born, and that's similar to us, right? Right. Yeah. There are those who want to suggest that. Mm-hmm. The very fact that it asks it, though, to me, underlines the fact that is worthy of going in there. Okay, so those are just some examples of the exhibits at the museum of things you would expect to find in the Torah, but to not. Now, the purpose of the museum is then to sort of sit at the exhibit and have discussion with your friends and knowledgeable scholars such as Mordechai, and then you and the discussion is the fruit of the question here. And so would you start with the Olam Haba question? What happens after you die?
Let's begin with that.
Yeah.
So, although, and as you mentioned, the Torah does allude to the idea. I mean, there's a punishment called v'nichrata ha-nefesh ahi ma'amer, the soul will be cut off. There are words in the Torah for execution, capital punishment. There right. are words in the Torah for dying.
Yeah.
But here you've got this term that the soul will be cut off from its people. It says that the sin will cling to the soul. It's interesting. Also, you have the expression used for death with righteous people. It's particularly obvious with Avraham. It says, Vayigva vayamot, he expired and died. Vayesaf alamav, he was gathered to his people. Vayikburu oto, and they buried him. So there's death, there's something happens, and then there's burial.
Right.
Type of like, so, but the question is still a question.
Yes.
And so in last week's Torah portion, Bechukotai, in Leviticus 26, the Abar Banel has seven approaches to this from various other rabbis that he summarizes. Of course, the Abar Banel is very lengthy. So the Kli Yakar summarizes the Abar Banel summary.
And now Mordechai is going to summarize the Kli Yakar.
And I'm going to now summarize the summary of the summary of the Abar Banel. So it's the Abar Banel summary number one, Kli Yakar summary. Okay, fine. So just a few ideas. One is Maimonides, who says that it's about altruism. God does not want to list the ultimate reward and punishment because he doesn't want us to be focused on that. He wants us to be focused on doing good because it's good, pursuing truth because it's true, and avoiding evil because it's evil, and so on. And I would add to that, if you look at sometimes people who are very focused, religions who are very focused on another world, and what happens in that world can end up doing horrific stuff here. You know, because, example, the conquistadors, when they came to South America, the Spanish conquistadors would take infants from their parents and baptize them to save them from burning in hell. And then they'd kill the infants to prevent the parents from corrupting them. Which, in the bizarre logic of heaven, hell, and that's what you look at it,
yeah,
they could justify that, but that's right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I see like in radical Islam, very similar, can pretty much justify most horrific, horrific actions in this world because you are so focused on another world. The Rambam says God wants us to be focused on this world. It's also a type of, you know, I don't think it's by coincidence that so many of our great medieval rabbis were also physicians. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's true, but there is criticism of Sister Maria Theresa that she provided comfort and consolation for the lepers in Calcutta, but she did not seek out cure because she saw suffering as something which was elevating, you know, and atoning for sin and so on and so forth. I don't know if it's even true about her. There are.
Yeah, I heard Christopher Hitchens and people like that make this claim, but
I don't know if it's true. I do not know if I should. Lashon Hara.
Because we saw when you and I were in Calcutta and other places, right, we saw the conditions that many of these people are living in. And, you know, apparently there are many people that the first time you get to see them, they're already on death's door. You're not going to.
You're right. I retract.
But I know people
there is
that.
A few.
Yes. I know.
Whereas for us, we see suffering here in this. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Alav HaShalom, there's a wonderful short video in which someone asked him about the Holocaust and suffering. And he said, but he said it much more eloquently than I could ever express it. He said, maybe God doesn't want us to understand suffering, because then we might cease to fight against it and struggle against suffering.
So
too much focus on the world to come, and this is an atonement, and this is rewarding this world for you, and so on and so forth, may cause us to lose our focus from what's happening right here and now: compassion, love, care, kindness, etc. And the Rambam, Maimonides, says it's altruism, which the Torah. So I guess like the Torah is like the ideal. So you do get the world to come mentioned in the other texts, but because they're the candies you offer to a child to induce him to read. But once the child learns how to read, right, it's a reward in and of itself. You don't need to offer her reward anymore. She's going to enjoy the book. So that's Maimonides' approach. That's one approach.
Okay.
There's another approach, which is the Ibn Ezra and Maharal similar, which is that in as much as the world to come is completely spiritual, it's not physical at all. He says the only way to describe something that we have no experience in is to use metaphor, allegory, and ideas and terminology from our experience. If you were trying to describe music to someone who's completely deaf, you might talk about vibration and so on, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what words would you use for a blind person to describe color. I don't know if it would be, I mean, you'd have to use examples from sound.
Yeah.
So the thing is, the Ibn Ezra points out that will people elevate their conception to the height to and understand that these are metaphor and I understand this is something higher than that, or will people drag down the world to come to their own experience and think of it as more literal? So what has happened? Certain religions where there is a lot of discussion about the world to come, the masses, in other words, those who are not listening to us.
Right. The ones who are watching those other videos, the 4 million people.
The unwashed, ignorant masses.
Exactly. 4 million people watching the guy smash a pie against his head.
Exactly. Right. Those people, right? What they will imagine is that the world to come, my camera for some reason loses focus occasionally. There you go. That's better.
There you go.
Either that or my face became fuzzy. I'm not.
You went out of focus.
My face became. Sorry.
That's it. The camera's fine.
Stepped into a different dimension. So what will happen is people will drag it down to their level. Right. So I always mention the story when I was living in Canada for 4 years, a place too dangerous for me to go to now. I was living in Canada. We bought a swing set. I bought a swing set to put up in the backyard, and it comes in a huge square flat cardboard box, which took up the entire roof rack of our station wagon. We actually had a station wagon. I'm schlepping the thing off the station wagon, and one of my kids looks up and he says, "Abba." And I was like, yeah, what is it? And he says, "Big pizza." Because in his limited 3 years of experience, if it's in a flat, square cardboard box, what is it?
Pizza.
It's a pizza. If it's a huge, flat, square cardboard box that takes up the entire roof rack of a station wagon, it is a big pizza. So that's what happened. I, maybe, right? Those who have, were scholars, maybe some imams who were talking about the virgins up in the sky and all that type of stuff, and the wine, women, and song as being, I don't know if they meant that. Maybe they meant something spiritual. And the people dragged it down to what they think it is. So I guess we don't want Jews to have the similar situation where we're thinking about the 72 caterers in the world to come. Right, that will be the Jewish idea.
Yeah. Version of it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the Ibn Ezra says that's the, and similar to the Ibn Ezra, the Maharal says that prophecy, the vocabulary of prophecy, also is limited by human experience. This maybe addresses also the issue of why it doesn't talk about the nature of God or the soul. Similar, I don't know, haven't thought about that, but it's like also limited to human experience. And since the verse says no human has seen it and come back, so it can't be talked about. So that's Ibn Ezra and Maharal. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari, and this is a bit of a polemic explanation, the king, pagan king, asked Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, you present your Torah, but you have not presented anything about the world to come, paradise, heaven, hell. He says, the Christian and the Muslim who came before you waxed poetic about these things. What's up? So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says that, he says it's easy to make predictions about the world to come. It's easy to make predictions about heaven and hell and threaten people with hell and promise people heaven because it's not verifiable and not falsifiable. So he says, if you are scared of contradiction, you will not make predictions about this world. You will exclusively make predictions about the world to come. He says, one of the signs of truth of the Torah is the Torah makes all its predictions about this world. Exile from Israel, worldwide dispersion, return to Israel, exile again, anti-Semitism, you'll be small in number, you'll be a blessing to the nations. One after the other. Those are all predictions which was Sir Karl Popper, the great British philosopher. I don't know if he invented the little chicken pieces. Is that in the hot sauce?
No, yeah, the chicken poppers, you mean?
That's Sir Karl Popper. He didn't.
And I think that might be one of his early
Nobel Prize. I would say it would be for the poppers. But in any case, other than his culinary skills, Karl Popper said that something is not really a meaningful statement if it's not falsifiable. And you know, like the Talmud says, you want to lie, make sure your witnesses live far away. And as we say here in New Jersey, I live not far from Newark, if you want to lie, make sure your witnesses are in the foundations of the building in which you are standing. Right. So indeed, those who talk all about the world to come, that's it. They say, give me your money or your children or you will burn in hell forever. No one's going to come back and say, what do you mean? I didn't give Becher a cent. I had a great time in heaven. Okay, it's not going to happen. So it's a safe prediction. The Torah is interested in truth, so it gives risky predictions. Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, Nachmanides says that the Torah tells me things which are what he calls chidush, novel. Things which are obvious, self-evident, Torah doesn't tell me. He says, the idea that there's a connection between our morality and spirituality and our physical success, rain, various blessings, peace, he says, that's completely miraculous. There's nothing in the laws of gravity that say that if you're a philanthropist, you'll fall slower. Right? There is nothing in the laws of biology that say the disease will avoid you if you are kind to other people. That's the thing. Anytime there's a correlation between the morality of the Jewish people and their physical success or failure, that's miraculous. He says, but to tell me that if the Jewish people become more similar to God, cultivate a relationship to God, therefore they'll be similar and have a relationship with God is type of tautology. It's obvious. You don't need to say, it's like the Talmud puts it, lama likra svarahu. Why do I need a verse? It's logical, right? Or as, I don't know why it came to my mind now, but Calvin, not the philosopher.
Calvin and Hobbes.
Calvin and Hobbes. He's nailing nails into the coffee table. And his mother comes in and sees him and goes, what are you doing? What? And anyway, or something like, or Hobbes says to him, did you ask your mother if you could do that? And he says, answers, questions where the answer is obvious, I don't need to ask. So he didn't ask, so I guess it's a similar idea, maybe. But that's the Ramban. The Sefer Achinuch says a similar idea in his intro. Why did I point there for an intro? But whatever, in his intro, so he says that, says if you believe there's no world to come, no life after death, and you look at this world, and the sum total of when humans have reached perfection, look at it from an individual level. You know, get rid of the first 20 years because of adolescence and hormones and stuff like that. And then, you know, maybe get rid of the last 10 years because just like, you know, it just takes too long to get anywhere with a walker, right? And you got the middle, and then you got this middle time, right, where maybe you'll achieve greatness and about a quarter of that you're sleeping. And then you have to, you're eating and showering and flossing, all very important stuff. But he says, seriously, you know, you're looking at, and if you look at the world as a whole, at the amount of people in the world and all of history, and how many have achieved, because if there's no world to come, you're meant to achieve the greatness and everything that God wanted right here. It doesn't look like a great ROI. You know what I mean? The return on investment, not awesome, right? If you had a factory, like this planet was a factory for producing godliness, right? And the percentage, the successful production is what it is. I mean, you would, obviously you'd burn it down and collect insurance, but you would not, right?
Yeah.
It's not a, right? It doesn't seem a profitable venture. If you say that this life is a part of a greater continuity of life, and then it actually makes sense, right? Quite possible. We're only seeing a slice of the picture. So those were some of the answers that were given that were cited by the Kli Yakar. There's also, I remember Rav Moshe Shapiro talking about this. He was saying, this is Rav Yosef Albo mentions this idea. You know, the Hebrew word for this world, the Hebrew term for this world is Olam Hazeh, this world. So if I ask you, what's the grammatical opposite of this world, of this? What would you say? What's the word that, what's the opposite of this world?
That world.
That, exactly. This world, that world. So in Hebrew, it's Olam Hazeh, this world. So what should be the other world should be Olam Ahu.
Olam Ahu.
Yeah, that world. But it's not. It's this world and Olam Haba, the world that comes. Very strange. So I don't know if I'm conflating Rav Moshe with, but I think Rav Moshe was basing this on Rav Yosef Albo, that it's that world is not that there's that world that exists, and you know, like all the jokes about you get to the gate and they say which door you go into. He's saying you actually create. The life that we live beyond this life is created by what we do here. So it's so personalized that it's really every person's life relived on a spiritual plane and the spiritual implications and moral implications of everything they did here. Can't talk about that. It's like, it's just life is, it's your life.
Right.
So, type of interesting. That's why it's the world
that comes
from this world.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that, you know, in I remember Moshe pointing this out, that in the Mishnaic Hebrew, the word kever, which means grave, also made the womb, cervix, or the womb, right, p'ticha taket, which is just seems to be morbid.
Yeah.
So Reb Moshe was saying, because just as the womb is a portal from a world in which the fetus is being prepared for life in this world, and depending on the mother's, I guess, diet and exercise, and is she smoking, is she on drugs, does she listen to rap, whatever, these will affect the fetus, right? Yeah. It will be born. So the kever, the grave, is type of like the similar idea.
Yeah.
What we do in this world, we are being, will be, so to speak, giving birth to our future self.
I feel like he also mentioned it in the name of Reb Chaim Volozhin, but you're saying this is already in Reb Yosef Albo?
I don't know for sure. I think so. This similar idea.
Right. For some reason, it stuck in my head that he was saying it in the name of Reb Chaim Volozhin.
Yes, Reb Chaim Volozhin does say the Olam Haba thing, and he translates when it says Le Olam Haba, it doesn't mean every Jew has a portion in the world to come. It actually means towards the world to come. So that, he says in Ruach Chaim, in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, he does say that idea. Uh-huh. But to put it together with why it's not in the Torah, the idea that's Rabbi Yosef Albo.
Got it.
And I remember also the Shalah, Rabbi Shaya Halevi Horovitz. This is the last one.
Yeah.
And this, I think, also Rabbi Moshe spoke.
He did. He quoted this. Yeah.
Now, if you think rain means precipitation, you are reading the Torah on a very low level. And he says, really, everything in the Torah which is physical is actually a metaphorical language for something spiritual. And the Torah is written, as I think Lubavitcher Rebbe puts it this way, that the Torah is written in such a way that a six-year-old can read it and understand it, and a 60-year-old philosopher can read it and understand it, and someone living in Spain in the 12th century can understand it, and someone living in California in the 21st century can understand it, which is mind-boggling that the Torah is written in such a way that it can be understood and be inspirational for people throughout the last 3,300 years in every language, every geopolitical and circumstance. And so it's written in that way that the person who's more sensitive will be reading it in a different way than someone who's less. Right?
Yeah.
So
I remember him saying something like, all I see when I look at the Torah is Olam Haba.
Yes,
exactly. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, he used that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, and we don't, person who doesn't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is because they're, yeah.
Thank you for that. Now,
some of those might apply to the soul and to the nature of God.
Yes, I agree. Or
he wants us to explore these things. I don't know. It's
Dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs.
What do you have to say about the dinosaurs? Why aren't the dinosaurs mentioned in the Torah?
So in Bereshis, Genesis, when the Torah does speak about creation,
yeah,
it doesn't really talk much about individual species. In fact, doesn't talk at all about individual species.
Taninim. I mean, there's
great large beasts.
Right.
But it talks about land animals, talks about birds, and it talks about the great beasts.
Right.
Otherwise, it doesn't really mention species. I mean, would I?
Right.
How many
species of animals
on this planet?
Right.
10 million? 20 million?
Right.
I don't know. So now, as I forgot who put it this way, but it is important. The Torah is not there to teach us paleontology or geology. That's not what it's there for. All right. The goal of the Torah is to teach us morality, is to teach us closeness to God. So, example, there are places in Tanakh, and I think it's in the book of Yoshua. It says there's a pasuk, Vayishkot ha'aretz arboim shana. The land was quiet for 40 years.
Yeah.
Now, it's a little mind-blowing because there are entire chapters about a week and the war that went on for a few. It's like, right? And then you got 40 years, one verse.
Yeah.
Because there are also kings and dynasties who don't get mentioned in the Torah. because they're not relevant to the goal, which is the teaching of morality. So dinosaurs, not relevant. And it's type of interesting, you know.
Can you think of something else like that?
Yeah,
a bunch
of kings that lived and died, and dynasties that lived and died.
I think we once had a back and forth. It was mostly a humorous back and forth about volcanoes. Right? Remember? So that could be another example. Like, what? Yes, there are volcanoes, but it didn't come. I mean, do I have to mention everything that existed?
Every natural phenomena.
Right, like
tornadoes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Right. Having been in Kansas, that's something that's on my mind.
Yes.
Right. So yeah. Type of interesting. There is a people should look at this. It's just it's delightful. There's a commentary on the Mishnah, Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz, called Tiferes Yisrael. Commentary on the Mishnah. He's like 1800s, I believe, 19th century, and he's got something called Drush or Hachaim at the end of Nezikin, in which he discusses, so he says, how they recently, human curiosity has drawn people to start digging into the depths of the Carpathian Mountains and into the something mountains near Baltimore in America. And they have found the bones of massive animals, and he has in Yiddish, Brontosaurus. You've never seen so many alephs and ayins in your entire life. I've seen Hechsherim, the Rebbe of, but you know, like it's gorgeous to see names of dinosaurs written in classic Yiddish spelling in this in Rashi script in the back of the Mishnah, and he says he was delighted to see this because he says he's always had a theory that that period of creation that the Torah is talking about is the fourth on this planet. And there were different epochs beforehand. He says, clearly, these are remnants of the previous epochs,
nice.
You know, which we would probably call Jurassic and, you know, Cambrian, Jurassic, and et cetera, right? But he says, and therefore, so his understanding is that, they're not mentioned because it's not part of our current epoch of creation, so not relevant to us. But their remnants are there. I saw there was an archaeologist, who was suggesting that the Romans and Greeks, and various peoples who had myths about fantastic beasts and animals, was because they probably found fossils of dinosaurs. And now, they were not stupid people, but they had no idea. They'd never heard of fossilization.
Right.
They had never heard of extinction. Right.
So they might have thought they just happened.
They're around.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my professors, when I was doing my master's, was talking about this, and he mentioned that he saw an encyclopedia published in New York in 1901, there was an article about dinosaurs. And in the article, I said, there are very likely dinosaurs still existing in parts of Africa.
In 1901.
Parts of Africa that we are not familiar with at this point.
We know King Kong was around that time. Clear.
But that's an island. Yeah. So isn't that wild? So the idea that the Romans, found bones and said, oh, I guess there must be a big creature. It's very logical to believe that. That's what this archaeologist claimed. I think she's probably right.
Nice.
Why were we talking about it in class? We were talking about, it was Professor Stephen Fine, who he wrote a fantastic book about the menorah.
Whether it's rounded, you mean?
No, it's not just that. It's about literally everything you wanted to know about the menorah. The menorah from the Bible.
I only have four things I wanted to know about the menorah.
From the Bible to modern Israel. And it's published by, I think it's Harvard University. Published it, and it's epic. So he taught a class on Jewish iconography.
How do you have room? Because you just pulled out a book like that out of your bookshelf right there.
Yeah,
there's not Do you have like several rooms that are just floor to ceiling bookshelves? Because if I just had like a bookshelf, like it looks like in the back of the kind of bookshelf you have where books are convenient to be reached while you're working at your desk. And the book you chose to have back there is the book that has everything a person wanted to know about the menorah. And if you look at the height, that is like, that is choice real estate back there.
That's choice real estate.
You could add anything back there. You have everything a person would want to know about a menorah back there.
Well, I do have shelves here, like you can't see.
Okay.
I have shelves here. Fine. I have books down there. I have a shelf over there. And this is my office. Most of my books are not in the office.
Okay, they're down fine.
Upstairs,
but also, it just occupies like a very convenient place to reach to on your shelf. Yeah.
So your books there about the Roman beasts that were on the base of the menorah depicted on the Arch of Titus has got beasts on the base.
A dragon. Yeah.
So someone said, well, isn't it clear that those are idolatrous and they're not?
That Lubavitcher Rebbe. I think Lubavitcher Rebbe, it's one of his proofs that it wasn't the menorah.
He discussed that. And one of the things he points out is that the belief in dragons has nothing to do with idolatry. The belief in these fantastic beasts is because the Romans found fossils and came to the conclusion that there must be fantastic beasts around. So, okay, no problem. All right. So in any case, I think we're
thank you. We did a couple of samples. The main
I think
one of the main advantages of having this discussion is to remind ourselves of the beauty and value of a good question. And sometimes questions are not about what's there, but about what isn't there. And stay curious.
That's great. And folks, please suggest to your friends, share our podcast.
Not the guys who are watching the 4 million videos of the guy swallowing a watermelon whole or whatever they're doing. Not those guys. Mordechai does not want those guys watching our video. We want thoughtful, dignified human beings.
All 15 of them. Okay. So
hundreds. And there are hundreds of people watching this.
I don't believe it. Anyway.
It says on the views on YouTube. Okay. You don't trust the views on YouTube?
No, I don't trust anything on YouTube.
Oh, my.
Okay. All right.
Be well.